Future-Proof Extra from News Talk.
Now, sex can be a lot of things. It can be fun, it can be exciting, scary, a little bit tricky, or maybe even downright weird. And that's just for us humans. But what about the sexual exploits of other animals, more specifically the creatures that live in the deep blue sea? Well, it turns out they lead full and, shall we say, colourful sex lives, to say the least. Dr. Mara J. Hart is the director of discovery at the nonprofit Future of Fish and author of Sex and the Sea. She joins me now. Welcome to the programme, Mara. Why are you interested in how fish do it?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's a great question. My obsession with the sex lives of fish. It's really because sex is at the heart of sustainability, and it's a fascinating topic, especially when you dive into the deep. So I'm interested in study ocean conservation and how, you know, we can better take care of our ocean environment. But for years, you know, stories of ocean declines and all the threats and all the problems are kind of depressing. They're not really motivating. So I was looking for a way that we could engage folks to be interested in and care about the oceans in a way that was more inspiring. And I find nothing more inspiring, exciting, and truly awesome than sharing with people the bizarre and beautiful ways that animals have sex in the ocean and how different that is and why that matters for our future ability to continue to enjoy all of the amazing benefits that the oceans give us.
Have sex is not a very scientific way of putting it, is it? It's, you know, how fish have sex, like they're, you know, in a little sardine tin, smoking cigarettes. Yeah. tell me how, because I was interested in what you said there. You said it's at the heart of sustainability, and you got really interested in this because of corals. How is fish sex at the heart of sustainability?
Sure. So, well, you brought up the word. So if we replace sex with reproduction, right, which is a little bit more of a science-y term, that means producing, right? It's making the next generation over and over and over again. And, you know, if we want to have the amazing food and nutrition that seafood gives us, if we want all of the incredible pharmaceutical, you know, drugs and chemicals that marine life provides, if we want the protection of our coasts through oyster reefs and coral reefs, then the oysters and corals and fish and everybody of, you know, that is in the ocean today need to make the next generation of ocean life for tomorrow. And so that takes sex. That's how it's all done.
When you say medicines, what do you mean? What medicines do we get from the sea?
Oh, so there are many that we are currently getting and many more that are predicted to be out there that we don't even know about yet. But marine life produce all sorts of novel compounds. In fact, I believe it's a deep sea bacteria I think it's a bacteria that contributed to some of the testing that they're working on right now for COVID. Right. And that came from deep sea vent. But because life forms are so different in the ocean, they have a different set of chemicals that they use and compounds that they create for their own, existence. And those are things that we can harvest. And so there are cancer-fighting compounds, heart disease, neurological diseases like Parkinson's. All of those have animal-derived compounds that are from animals that live in the ocean. And so, you know, there's just a whole treasure trove there of medicinals that we're just starting to learn about. In fact, I think there's even a seaweed right now that has some compounds that are thought to help folks who have COVID be able to fight it off better.
Right. I hadn't heard some of that stuff. So it's very interesting. So we're going to get into it now, and I will absolutely not be entertaining any live line squeamish texts about this feature. Okay. We're talking about fish and reproduction. Okay. So we're going to use some, they might be a little bit inky, some of these terms, but let's just realize we're talking about the natural world, right? David Attenborough doesn't get the text you guys send me, so just knock it off for the next 10 minutes. So let's talk about Finding Nemo and the creative license that the makers Pixar took as you talk about when they talk about this sex change that's sort of almost a default in the life of fish.
Yeah. So yeah, and you got it. That's a great phrase, because for so many species in the ocean, and including fish, sex change is sort of part of the natural life cycle. And so with clownfish, we have a situation where they change sex from males to females. And part of the reason for this to have it make sense is that, unlike in mammals, so in any female mammal, we are, you know, the females have all the eggs they will ever have when they're born, and that number goes down over time, right, as we age. That is not the case with fish and shrimp and oysters. The larger the female, the more eggs she can carry, and that number increases exponentially. So, you know, if a female doubles in size, she may carry 10 times as many eggs. So in clownfish, they're, you know, tiny little candy-colored fish on a reef. And so there's a lot of predators out there. And so they tend to hunker down. They find this little anemone that they live in. And a male and a female will partner up. And because they're partnering up, the male and the female both benefit if the female is largest, right? Because a small male can make enough sperm to fertilize all of a female's eggs, because sperm is cheap. It's easy to make. So the male and female both want the female to be biggest. So what happens is you have this big dominant female, and she sort of bullies the male so that the male stays kind of smaller than her. Then that male will bully any other of the little juveniles who arrive to that anemone and keeps them in a sort of prepubescent male state. And so it sort of maintains this order. Then when the female dies, the male, the dominant male, will transition to become the next female. And the biggest juvenile, who's been kind of living lying in wait, if you will, he will mature to a male. And then the whole system repeats. So in Finding Nemo, when Nemo's mom died at the very beginning, his dad, Marlin, as the dominant male, would have actually sex changed into Marlene and then likely mated with his son.
Oh no, you know, Nemo. What the creepy, yeah. Kids listening to this, that's my favorite movie ruined. Thanks a lot for that, Mara.
Ruined, but very strategic. Very strategic, so they can make more
it's efficient fish. It's efficient. I mean, efficient. It makes sense, yeah. To be able to switch sex whenever you want, but obviously it costs. And so yes. For example, something like a lobster, for it to change gender, is that something that happens?
It isn't. So lobsters, as far as we know, do not change sex, and not every species does. And what's really interesting is that it really depends on there being an advantage. And so other species, such as parrotfish, they change sex in the opposite direction, because one male in many species of parrotfish, one male will dominate a group of females. They form harems. And so in that case, you want to be a big, strong male who can defend a territory and defend all your females. And so as a small female, you can reproduce with that male. And then as you grow, when the conditions are right, when you feel you might be big enough and strong enough, you can then actually transition into a male and challenge your alpha male, or you can go off and form your own harem. In other species, there are different strategies. And in lobsters, they use a very different strategy to mate. And there isn't a need for sex change. The energy required to make that transition just doesn't make it worth it. And so they use a very different strategy. And we see this again and again, all of these diverse ways that animals woo, you know, how they find and seduce, and then finally kind of seal the deal, if you will, in the ocean. There's just so many different ways, and sex change is common, but it's just one. And then, of course, it comes in all varieties in and of itself.
What do lobsters do then?
So lobsters have a great system. They're very romantic and they're very kinky. It's sort of a combination. So with lobsters, the females have a pouch at the base of her tail where the males deposit sperm, And then she can draw on that sperm to fertilize several clutches of eggs, several batches of eggs.
Wow.
And so, yeah. And so for both the female and the male, the best time to mate is actually right after the female has molted. And this is the case, I'm describing Maine lobsters or the American lobster, the ones with the big claws. And so after the female molts, that pouch is fresh. It's empty, right? And so for the female, she wants to mate right away so the males can deposit a whole bunch of sperm in there. She can have a full pouch and be off on her way and not actually have to worry about mating again for a while.
Yeah.
For the males, he wants to have a female with an empty pouch so that he can put all of his sperm, you know, as much of his sperm in it as possible. There are times when a male will deposit sperm with a female who's already mated, and so his sperm mixes with another male sperm or multiple male sperms. And then you can have sperm competition, which actually can reduce the ability, you know, it reduces how much one individual male is able to fertilize her eggs.
Yeah.
So the males don't really like that, right? So they both want it right after the female molts. But when a female molts, she's soft. She can't even support her own weight. You know, she can't even stand up. And during mating season, male lobsters are extremely aggressive. They will attack males or females who come approaching them. So what is she going to do? She's this soft body, vulnerable creature, and she's got to go try to have sex with this really aggressive male. So her strategy is before she molts, when she finds the male who she chooses, she will approach his den. And these males, again, are very territorial. They'll protect a den. And she actually will go up to the den and then she'll shoot him in the face with her urine. Oh. And so she sprays him in the face with her pee. And her pee has this very strong chemical signal. And fortunately for her and conveniently, lobsters have their bladders right on top of their brains, and they have these two little nozzles underneath their eye stalks. So she can actually shoot her pee forward. Okay. So she sort of peers around, shoots the pee forward, and then she runs away as fast as she can before that male can come and attack her. She does this for two to five days in a row. And by the end of the week, that chemical signal in her urine actually has this transformative effect on the male. And by the end of that week, he actually will invite her and only her into his den. And they will cohabitate for a couple of days. They'll live together. They'll do their lobster thing. They hunt, they hang. And then when she feels that the molt is really imminent, it's about to happen, she goes around and they do this amazing ritual where they will kind of face each other, and he sort of bows down in front of her, and she rises up and she takes one of her big claws and she'll tap him on one shoulder and then the other.
No.
And scientists call this the knighting signal. And basically we think it's the signal that she's saying to him, hey, this is all about to happen. Don't go anywhere. Like, now's the time. Then she circles around behind him and she'll go to the back of the den, and it takes her a little while for her to basically slip out of her old shell. And the male will guard. Yeah, she kind of, you know, changes, and the male will guard the front of the den, and then he'll go back and he'll gently sort of stroke her with his walking legs and his antenna, and he sort of just like hovers around her. And then once she has molted, he very gently, he'll sort of brace himself with his big claws in the sand and his tail. And then he uses his walking legs almost like a hammock, and he'll scoop her up, roll her onto her back. And he sort of cradles her in his walking legs, pulls her in, and then they mate in the missionary position. You know, he's able to insert his specialized little legs that have called swimmerettes, and that's where he has his sperm deposit, goes into the pouch, takes only a few thrusts, and then he very gently lays her back down. He will then guard over her for the next 3 to 5 days as her new shell hardens, protecting her during this really vulnerable state. And then once she's ready to walk and is kind of good to go, she leaves the den. They probably never see each other again. And the next female will then show up on this doorstep and start spraying him in the face with her pee, and the whole system will start over. And
guys,
and
find yourself a woman who will love you like a Maine lobster will.
Exactly. It's pee is a powerful love potion in the ocean, but it's a great also example of how we can be impacting these systems without even realizing it, because we don't use such strong chemical signaling. Though if you go look up t-shirt smelling parties, your mind will be blown about how people are starting to do these weird dating games by smelling one another's t-shirts. But that's a subject for a different time. But in general, we don't tend to lead with scent as our main attractor. But in the ocean, a lot of animals do. And things like climate change are fundamentally changing the chemistry of the ocean. We're changing the pH of seawater, right? And so you can imagine what might happen if the changes in that seawater then scrambled the female's message, right? Or damaged the smell receptors on the lobsters so that this system of communication didn't work as well. That'd be a huge problem. Huge problem. Yeah. And it's not one that we would tend to think about, right? Because it's not how we mate most of us tend to seduce one another.
I wouldn't, you know, our listeners are pretty, they're pretty kinky. Let's talk a little bit about the fanfin anglerfish, because this, I think, is possibly one of the most remarkable mating rituals that I've ever heard of. Fish, yeah. Man, vegetable, whatever. Take us through this process, and then we might talk a little bit about what we're doing generally from an environmental point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. The fantail anglerfish is extraordinary. It's something straight out of sci-fi. So these are deep sea fish. They live in very cold, pitch black waters. So imagine sort of a perpetual night. And the males are born without the ability to feed themselves. In order for them to survive, they have to find a female fast. What they are born with, though, is the ability to smell. So they have an extremely good sense of smell. And so these very small males that could fit, you know, in the palm of your hand, they're born, and then they start swimming, kind of sniffing their way through the deep sea, trying to find a female. The females are about, you know, over 10 times bigger than the male in some cases. They're
so
huge.
So how big would that be?
Probably, I'm trying to think in metric for you guys, a third of a meter-ish.
Okay. Yeah.
About a foot.
Like a basketball?
Yeah, like a basketball, maybe a little bit smaller. But big, you know, and then the male is, you know, again, you know, the length of your finger. So
wow.
Quite a big difference in size. Mm-hmm. And so he's sniffing his way through these dark waters, and the female, who is the hunter, she's sort of floating around, and she has these incredibly beautiful bioluminescing long tendrils that sort of are splayed out around her like a big array. And then she has why they're called anglerfish is she has that little lantern that kind of dangles off of the front of her head, which lures in prey, and then she'll, you know, munch them with her huge jaws and fang-like teeth. So the male, once he kind of finds her smell, she's letting off these strong pheromones, I should say. So the female sits there, and she releases a very strong perfume scent into the water to attract these males to her. So he's sniffing his way through the dark, catches her scent, and then follows that to her. When he sees her, rather than being, you know, intimidated by this huge kind of gnarly looking animal, he gets very excited, and he just hones right in and tends to go towards her belly and bites. It's like a love bite.
Oh.
But that love bite, yeah, it's he literally bites onto her. It's sort of their first kiss. But that bite causes a chemical reaction. And that chemical reaction triggers huge changes in both the male and the female, but especially the male. His jawbones start to disintegrate, his flesh literally fuses into her body, and their two circulatory systems start to combine.
No.
Their blood vessels. Yeah, their blood vessels combine, and all of his internal organs start to dissolve except for his testes. Yeah. His testes actually start to mature and grow and pump out sperm. So at the end of the day, he basically becomes a permanently attached sperm factory for the female. It is an extremely efficient system that works really well in deep sea environments where it's hard to find mates. And the female, because their blood systems are combined, their circulatory systems are combined, we're pretty sure that she is able to, through hormones, when she ovulates, she most likely is able to kind of give signals for him to ejaculate at the same time so that they can coordinate the release of sperm and eggs. Wow. To maximize fertilization success. Yeah.
It's hard not to anthropomorphize these things, isn't it? And just sort of imagine what that would be like if you were a human.
I know. It's a little, or go the opposite, right? Imagine what we would be like if we were anglerfish. It's yeah. It's crazy. And it takes us, I mean, if you imagine the evolution of that, right? Like the amount of work and combining that has to happen is, it's incredible. And we're still just learning to figure it out. There was actually a study just this summer that looked at anglerfish immune systems. Because if you think about it, it's really opposite to what normally should happen when two individuals' bodies literally fuse together, right? Our bodies tend to reject a foreign body coming in, right? That's why when you have patients with organ transplants, they have to have all those immunosuppressant drugs, right? Yeah. To allow their body to receive someone else's organs. Well, here you have a female receiving an entire individual, right? And combining her body with his. That shouldn't work. But it does. And it turns out that one of the ways that it does is that these anglerfish have actually deleted one of the main parts of their immune system. And it's one of the parts that we all share. It's you know, we're vertebrates, fish are vertebrates. We actually share very similar immune systems in the basic sense. And these anglerfish have just deleted this whole branch that almost all other vertebrates have. So it's all to allow this kind of parasitic coupling to happen. So it's fascinating, and Sex and the Sea is something we're still learning so much about, just because it's so diverse and so strange and so foreign to what we ourselves experience.
So we talk about climate change, environmental issues, and I'm sure many people in Ireland would be familiar with, you know, the dangers of overfishing, but maybe you might give us some other things to think about that maybe aren't as obvious as let's not empty the seas and let's not put plastics in it. Size is one thing. How we fish according to size and the regulations around size, sometimes that can be ill thought out. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's true. It's one of these subtle details that can make a really big difference. And why, you know, it is a challenge to figure out how to manage fisheries well. It's a challenge though that we're getting better and better at. So what happens? So let's go back to the sex changing fish, for example. So imagine you have a species that is a sex changer, and let's just say for this example, it's something like a grouper that would change from female to males. So if you have this species and it is being fished, often fishers want to target the largest fish, right? That's where you get the most bang for your buck. You get your best fisher stories, but you also tend to get a better price in the marketplace for a larger fish. Well, if you have a sex-changing population, then all of those large fish are going to be males. And so even if you've set your catch limits, you know, the number of fish that you're supposed to take, even if those limits are correct in terms of only taking a certain number, if you are only taking all of one sex,
right,
you then are going to skew the ability of the females who are left to be able to find mates. Or what we often see is that it actually triggers sex change to happen sooner than it normally would. And again, because of these certain dynamics, that might mean that the sex change is less successful, or the females who would normally grow a little bit bigger and again have that much more eggs, again, because it's exponential number of eggs for each kind of growth of the female. As the females are changing sex sooner, it means you don't get all those eggs. You're losing a huge amount of eggs from the population. So these are just, that's just one example of how, gosh, it matters. Size matters as much as number in this case, because these animals are doing things again so differently. And what's challenging is we don't always know if a species is a sex-changing species. One species of grouper may be, and another species may not. So it's not that it's always consistent across type of fish. So it does prove a challenge. But again, we're coming up with new management techniques, a lot more data now. And as our awareness grows, we can start to be more precautionary and sort of allow for greater buffers, and also be much more, what's really necessary is that we really focus on good data, that we are really watching as we target species, as we are fishing, that we are collecting good information from those fisheries so that we can see what is happening to the best of our abilities, because only through good data can we actually know really what's happening to these populations, because it's all underwater, right? So it's not like on land where we can literally see what our harvest looks like, or in forestry where we're cutting down trees and replanting them. We can kind of monitor that impact better and see how those plants are growing or not, how animals and livestock are growing or not. But in the ocean, we don't have that visual check. So the only information we have comes from good science and good fisheries data, where fishermen are reporting on their catches and we're reporting on the size, and that information then can be used by governments and other management bodies to better protect and monitor and enforce the regulations that we need to make sure that we have fish today and fish in the future.
Dr. Mara Hart from Future of Fish and author of a new book, Sex and the Sea. Look out for it. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.